What if we told you America's economy is strong enough that we can have nice things? I'm Catherine Ann Edwards, and I'm an economist.
I'm Robin Rousey, and I'm an editor.
Every Tuesday on Optimist Economy, we talk through economic policies that matter. Social Security, the minimum wage, immigration, childcare.
And we look at the research and the data, not just politicized hot takes.
You'll probably learn something.
You'll probably laugh.
And you'll finally understand why we can have a better economy.
Search for Optimist Economy wherever you listen to podcasts.
The power is out in Cuba, and people are protesting their government on the street. That does not mean that talk of a U.S. takeover is being warmly received there.
The notion that a foreign president, let alone the president of the United States, says that he's going to take Cuba and do whatever he wants with it, that is a gift to the ruling Communist Party.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, Cuba in crisis. Also on the show, more Iranian leaders have been assassinated. We'll hear who they were and what happens now that they're gone.
Plus, it is almost the end of Ramadan. A cookbook author shares memories of the foods she ate when breaking the fast as a child.
Ramadan only comes once a year. I really want to have similar dishes to what I had growing up and to recreate those exact memories.
That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us today. The news from the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran is coming fast and furious. In the U.S., the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Joe Kent, has announced his resignation, saying that Iran posed no imminent threat to the United States. Also, Iran has vowed not to release its grip on the Strait of Hormuz and therefore global oil markets.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced on television that Israel's military has killed a top Iranian official. Netanyahu said Ali Larijani was, quote, the boss of the Revolutionary Guards, which is a gang of gangsters that run Iran, end quote. He added that Israel is weakening the Iranian regime so that the Iranian people can remove it. The World's Shireen Jafari joined me today with the latest. She started by explaining who Larijani was.
Ali Larijani was a conservative politician and a longtime insider of the Islamic Republic. He was very close to the late Supreme Leader. And the Supreme Leader had personally placed him in some key positions. For example, he was the Speaker of the Parliament for 12 years. And in that role, he shaped legislation and mediated between different factions. Then in the mid-2000s, Larijani became Iran's top nuclear negotiator. He represented Iran in these talks. And then he served as the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, where he was more involved in the security structure of the country. And Larijani was an outspoken critic of the U.S. and Israel, but he had some level of autonomy when it came to negotiations and diplomacy with the West. He wasn't just a sort of a yes man when it came to the Supreme Leader.
So how did Larijani's position change after the U.S. and Israel killed the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei?
He was more or less running Iran's affairs since the Supreme Leader was killed back at the end of February. The son of Ali Khamenei, Mojtaba, who was appointed to lead the country after his death, has been absent from public. Last Friday, at a press conference, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that Mojtaba has been injured. And we've also seen some reports from Iran that suggest that he is recovering at a hospital in Tehran. So Larijani became, in effect, the person who was running the country during this time.
These Iranian leaders, these top Iranian leaders like Larijani, they must know that they are targets of the Israelis and the American military, and yet they're not all in hiding. What does that tell us?
You're right, Marco. These people know and understand that they have targets on their backs, but they keep showing up in public because they want to project a sense of strength. I mean, Larijani, along with President Masoud Pezeshkian, as well as Ghulam Hossein Ejei, who's the Chief of Justice, were all out in public just a few days ago.
آخرین نفس و تا آخرین لحظه در مقابل اونها بیستیم.
Here, the Chief Justice was giving an interview with the state TV when a bomb goes off nearby. He doesn't flinch and carries on with his message, saying that people are not scared of these attacks and they will carry on undeterred. One reason that these officials show up in public is that this is a way for them to show that they have things under control and that there is no power vacuum.
How has Larijani been viewed publicly?
He's part of the establishment that does have some support base inside Iran. But for the majority of Iranians, they see people like Larijani as being responsible for their misery. You might recall that back in January, there were major protests across Iran. People came out to the streets protesting the high prices. Larijani was a key person who was responsible for the crackdown on the protesters. Thousands of people were killed. Some others were arrested. So for many Iranians, Larijani was a hated figure, and they really won't mourn his death.
So Larijani, as you said earlier, Shirin, was at one point involved in negotiating a nuclear deal with the West. How could eliminating people like him impact any future off-ramp for this war and any future deal?
It's hard to know for sure. I mean, if the killings of officials continue at this rate, will there be a government in place to negotiate with? That's a question that we don't have an answer to right now. But what we know is that at least one other official was killed last night. That's Ghulam Reza Soleimani, who heads a powerful paramilitary force inside Iran. Larijani was seen as this kind of person who could sit down with foreign leaders and hammer out deals behind the scenes and be involved in diplomacy. Some analysts pointed out today that Larijani's death could mean that we see even more hardline figures taking on prominent roles within the government, although we know that anyone who takes up any leadership position could be the next target for Israel.
The World, Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
As we just heard, Israel has assassinated Iranian political figure Ali Larijani, as well as Ghulam Reza Soleimani. He led the group of volunteer fighters for the Revolutionary Guard, known as the Besiege, that helped crush recent protests. Israel maintains that the men were masterminds of terror, not politicians, which, if deemed true, could make these assassinations in keeping with international law. So says Yifa Segal at Israel's David Institute for Security Policy.
It is legal when you are at war, and certainly justifiable under international law to say that there was what's called casus belli, like there was definite cause for this war.
She says Iran has been attacking Israel for years using its proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah.
This was directed by this leadership that has directed all these illegal terroristic orders for their army and for the army of their proxies all over the world.
I understand her point. And goodness knows the Iranian regime has been responsible for a lot of deaths, both within Iran and outside. But who is to decide?
That's Margaret McMillan, an author and historian with expertise in the long-held rules of engagement during wartime. We called her today because she was just on our show talking about recent breaks with those rules and norms. But that conversation happened right before these assassinations, and we wanted her take after. She says that what happened this morning may be legal. That was not a determination that she felt qualified to make, but that either way, it sets a dangerous precedent.
I do think there are very important questions here, which we have to really think about. I mean, how do we live in a world in which people simply say, I have a right to decide to do what I want to do? I feel like killing someone today, I'm going to go and do it.
The U.S. and Israel have already killed other top Iranian leaders, which McMillan points out so far has not forced Iran to back down. She added that historically, killing a country's leader has often led to a failed state, which she says serves no one's interests. Since the U.S. and Israel unleashed their war against Iran, the ripple effects have been steadily spreading across global travel. Every day, airlines are canceling flights due to aerial conflict in the region, along with drone strikes closing airports across the Middle East. Oil prices are also rising, which has some countries calling for workers to stay home to avoid gassing up their cars. The world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, has the latest.
When the U.S. first attacked Iran late last month, it was a shock to the airline industry.
The unfolding situation in the Middle East has triggered flight disruptions around the world, with major airlines canceling flights, leaving passengers stranded.
Countries across the region closed their airspace, tens of thousands of people stuck with no way to get home. In the weeks since, the industry has fought to establish some semblance of normalcy, and evacuation flights have successfully repatriated international travelers from major Middle Eastern hubs. But industry analysts say ongoing strikes, especially drone attacks at or near airports, have caused more than a bit of turbulence.
There's a few different ways that flights have been affected. If we're talking about airlines that operate to the region, the schedules are an absolute disaster.
Ian Pechnik is with Flight Radar 24, a site that analyzes flight patterns around the world.
Yesterday, we saw a drone attack that struck a fuel tank near Dubai International Airport.
The Iranian attack forced officials to close the UAE's airspace, causing several international flights already in the air to make dramatic U-turns.
So we see a dozen flights turn around en route to Dubai and go back to places like Edinburgh, London, Lisbon, Frankfurt. So it's an 8 to 10 hour flight to nowhere, basically.
Pechnik says the incident put into sharp perspective just how tenuous the situation is for international air travel at the moment, with Mideast hubs getting attacked, quickly returning operations to normal, then reopening for travel, only to be shuttered after another strike. It's forced the industry into a difficult financial situation. Some carriers are avoiding the region entirely for long-haul paths between Europe and Asia. They're either traversing a northern corridor through Turkey, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, or a southern corridor through the Mediterranean, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. Those alternative routes are costly, as are those U-turns for flights.
Airlines only make money when they're flying, but if they have to fly from location A to location A again, they're not making that money. And that becomes a real problem as these conflicts go on.
According to the World Travel and Tourism Council, the conflict is costing the travel industry up to $800 million per day. Individual Middle Eastern carriers are losing $200 million daily. On top of that, there's the rising cost of fuel.
20 million barrels of oil per day are no longer making it to the market.
That's Patrick Dahan, who heads up petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy.
And that has caused a massive shift in supply and demand. Oil prices have skyrocketed because of the sudden jolt and reduction in available oil supply. And that has pushed up prices across the globe for anything derived from oil.
That includes jet fuel. Dahan tells me air travel has been particularly hard hit, with oil transport nearly cut off in the Strait of Hormuz, a critical shipping lane between Iran and Oman.
Jet fuel prices in some instances are up double that of gasoline, approaching $1.50 a gallon increase in the last 12 days.
Fuel for planes is particularly vulnerable because the supply is tighter than regular gasoline, and diversions due to the conflict are burning up even more fuel than usual. Still, drivers across the world are feeling the effects of the war too, with prices at the pump jumping by up to 25% globally. Dahan says countries that rely directly on oil shipments from the Strait of Hormuz have seen the sharpest jumps, particularly in Asia.
Those are countries that have already started to put, in some instances, use restrictions on consumption because the risk of disruption is significant.
India, Bangladesh, the Philippines, Thailand, and China have instituted gas consumption restrictions, energy-saving measures, or fuel rationing. In Pakistan,
essential services ko chhodkar baki tamam jagahon par
Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has ordered half of public sector employees to work from home, introduced a four-day work week, and closed schools for 2 weeks to conserve energy. Sri Lanka just introduced a similar measure for public workers, making every Wednesday a holiday for the foreseeable future. And analysts say we're likely to see even more countries take these steps as the war drags on. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Just ahead, Ramadan means fasting, but there's also feasting to break the fast. A cookbook author in London takes us into her Ramadan kitchen. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Muslims around the globe are nearing the end of Ramadan, the holy month of prayer and fasting. Preparations for Eid al-Fitr, celebrating breaking of the fast, are well underway. The holy month is about much more than food, but as with so many holidays, food is important. Chef Ilhan Mohammed Abdi has written a cookbook for exactly this time called The Ramadan Kitchen, Nourishing Recipes from Fast to Feast. She joins me from her home in London. Ilhan, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with the first meal of the day during the month of Ramadan, eaten before sunrise. You write in your cookbook that when you were little, those pre-dawn meals felt sacred. Can you tell me how?
Sure. So when I was younger, I wasn't fasting. I wasn't at an appropriate age to fast. But my older siblings and my parents would be awake at the crack of dawn, getting ready to start eating, and I'd sit at the top of the stairs and I'd see the lights on and everyone making noise and I'd want to join in. So I was allowed to join in and eat something, but obviously I wasn't allowed to fast, and my daughter currently does the same thing.
What is the recipe, if you had to pick one, in this section of your book that you most identify with suhoor, this pre-dawn meal?
I'd probably say seren, which is like a barley porridge. And it's full of fiber, it's full of protein, and it's really nourishing, and it will take away that hunger throughout the entire day.
So is it common to try to eat something big and hearty that will stick with you throughout the day during this meal?
Not so much big, okay. But something hearty, something full of protein, something full of fiber. Just dates and water is encouraged because there's a lot of fiber in the dates itself.
I love that each of the recipes, both in this section of your cookbook and then the rest of it, draw inspiration from different parts of your life, your heritage. There's baked beans, which you note are classic in Britain, but that you have always cooked in a Somali way. There's bread pudding that draws from your mother's Egyptian heritage.
Yes.
Is it especially important to you to draw in these threads of your heritage during Ramadan when you cook, or is that something you do all the time?
I think it's important because Ramadan only comes once a year, and it's about familiarity for me. So I really want to have similar dishes to what I had growing up and to recreate those exact memories. Obviously, I bring in some new dishes, some that aren't even in the cookbook, like a jack and potato, because it's a very classic British meal and I absolutely love it. But I do try to keep some of the dishes throughout the entire Ramadan, year after year.
So there's traditional dishes everybody looks forward
to. Yeah, there's traditional, exactly, that you'll find every single year in every household.
And what are those traditional dishes that you really stick with?
You'll have samosas, you'll have bur, you'll have bur couscous, you'll have malawah. There's a few. There's sherbet.
Describe a couple of those last ones for me.
Sure. So sherbet is a barley stew with meat. So it's usually with lamb, and it completely breaks down. It's cooking for hours and it's absolutely delicious. And you only just need a little bit with a bit of vinegar, and it's the first thing that you're having. There's samosas. We all know what samosas are. But we have a tuna samosa, which is in the book, which is absolutely delicious. And there's a coconut chutney that goes, like a spicy coconut chutney that goes with it. And then the bur is, one of them is like a beignet, and you have it with a bit of powdered sugar on top. And the other one, bur couscous, is like mini fried donuts, like little dumplings, and you soak them in syrup, cardamom syrup.
Mmm, those all sound so tasty.
Yeah, they're delicious.
So if we jump ahead to the evening meal, to break the fast, you have recipes for two stages of the evening meal in your book. Smaller bites for before prayers, right? And then larger mains for after. Can you tell me about those two stages of eating?
Yeah, so you haven't been eating all day long, so you don't want to go in and eat multiple different plates. So what you want to do is just break your fast with some tea, coffee, water, dates, and then these small bites, like I mentioned, those little donuts, little beignets, samosas. We've got bhajia, which is the closest thing I can relate it to as a falafel, but it's different. And then you go off and you pray and you let your stomach settle for a bit, and then you come back to enjoy your main meal.
And what kind of mains are classic on the Ramadan
table? So we've got macaroni bechamel, which is like imagine a lasagna but with pasta, and you've got the bechamel and cheese. We've got Somali rice, which is very simple. It's very fragrant rice, and it takes about 15 minutes to make. Then you can have Barisa Skulkaris, which is Somali rice, but you cook it with the lamb itself. We've got hearty meals like that. We've got lamb chops.
So this is where the hearty meal comes in during Ramadan.
Exactly.
But creating that every evening, especially if everyone is working, that's a lot of pressure for the main cook.
It is a lot of pressure, but everyone digs in. And I think with Ramadan, the last 10 days starts to slow down a lot.
Okay.
But that's what my book is about. A lot of the recipes are very simple. A lot of the recipes take 15 to 20 minutes. A lot of them can be pre-prepped and made beforehand or frozen. So it takes away that burden that a lot of people would feel.
I'm speaking with Chef Ilhan Mohammed Abdi about her new cookbook, The Ramadan Kitchen. What is it like cooking these very delicious-sounding foods when you have been fasting all day? How do you manage that?
Honestly, it's not as bad as it sounds.
Okay.
It sounds harder than it is, but it really isn't. But at the same time, you cooking for your family is a form of worship, so there's greater good to it.
Do you find that you are, reflecting more or being more intentional as you cook during Ramadan than on a random Tuesday?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. There's a lot more intention that goes into it. Mm. There's a lot more thought that goes into cooking during Ramadan.
What are you thinking about or reflecting on or being intentional about when you are cooking during Ramadan that is different than another time of year?
I'm gratitude. I'm just grateful that I'm able to cook the meals that I want, go and buy the ingredients that I want. If I'm missing something, if I have a craving for something, that I can just pop to the shops and create that craving that I have. There's a lot more gratitude that goes into Ramadan, the period of Ramadan.
So Eid al-Fitr, the festival marking the breaking of the fast, it starts in a few days. Have you all in your house been preparing for that?
Yeah, so we prepare by buying ourselves new clothes. Some people get henna done. You refresh your home. You make sure your house is all nice and clean. Some people will change carpets around and change curtains, brand new curtains. A lot of people will do a real big refresh. You get your presents out of the way and then just organize where and what you're doing, because a lot of the time we're house hopping between family.
Home to home. And then is there a lot of food prep that's also happening?
Yeah,
right now?
There's a lot of food prep, but we try to split it up. So it's almost like a potluck. Someone will take breakfast, somebody will take brunch, somebody will take the sweets and the teas. Or if we're going to one house, everyone will bring something just to take away the burden of the person hosting.
Right. Is there one dish that you always make that you are always responsible for, Eddie?
Yes. I make my Somali milk cake, which is fantastic.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Is there one key takeaway that you would like listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the cuisine that you're cooking or with Ramadan itself to take away from your cookbook?
Sure. That the Ramadan kitchen, although it's called the Ramadan kitchen and it's tailored to Ramadan, it can actually serve you the entire year. There are many recipes in there that I cook Monday to Friday every single week. And I had a cookbook club in Hawaii do about 30 recipes. And none of them observed Ramadan, which was testimony to how this book can actually serve people outside of Islam.
Ilhan Mohammed Abdi wrote the new cookbook, The Ramadan Kitchen, Nourishing Recipes from Fast to Feast. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got more global stories coming your way. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Across Cuba lately, the roads have been eerily empty of traffic. In many places, gas stations are open but selling virtually nothing ever since the U.S. choked off Cuba's access to foreign oil about 2 months ago. And yesterday, the dire lack of fuel triggered a nationwide blackout with the country's entire electrical grid collapsing. President Trump's comments to reporters at the White House on Monday only heightened the tension.
I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good. That's a big honor.
Taking Cuba
in some form. Yeah, taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth? They're a very weakened nation.
Cuba's President Miguel Díaz-Canel and Raúl Castro, his 94-year-old predecessor, are reportedly in talks with the Trump administration. The Cuban leaders say they'll soon be opening the country's economy to foreign investment, including from Cuban Americans. Earlier today, I spoke with journalist Ed Augustin, who's in Havana. He began by explaining how yesterday's nationwide blackout affected critical hospital care for children in Cuba.
There are kids around the country who are on ventilation. The batteries of those ventilators don't work. They should work, but they don't work because it's Cuba and the equipment's obsolete. So what happens is that the backup power kicks in, the backup generator kicks in, but it takes about a minute to kick in. And then after that, the engineers have to faff around setting up the ventilators again. And so for a few minutes, doctors and nurses have to dash, take out a manual rubber pump and very carefully, deftly press it at the right rate, pump it to keep newborns alive. That's extremely dangerous. When I was speaking to an anesthesiologist in Cuba's top pediatric hospital, when there was a near national blackout 2 weeks ago now, he told me that he was literally operating a newborn and that in the middle of the operation, the screen of the machine he was using to register the newborn's vitals went out. And he told me, quote, "It only goes out for a minute, but you feel like it's an eternity because you cannot monitor the baby's vital signs." You can broaden it out as well. Mortality of children under five is less determined by the hospital systems, so I've been told, and is more determined by the quality of food, quality of water. And that is being directly attacked as well by US policy right now because no fuel can come into the country. Tractors don't have diesel. They can't harvest. Even when food is produced and it can't get to market because there's no diesel, I'm seeing when I go to markets, prices rise. I'm seeing that vegetables are more wilted. With even more power cuts, the small amounts of food that people can buy goes off more quickly, spoils. And the trajectory is that things are getting worse.
Those are some mind-boggling knock-on effects from this fuel deprivation. Now, Cuban officials have been talking about big economic changes for the island. What is being put on the table?
So this is really interesting. The Trump administration has been talking about for weeks, we could even say boasting about, how a deal has been in the works and that Cuba and the United States are, quote-unquote, close to a deal. Last week, for the first time, the Cuban government recognized that negotiations are indeed underway. And last Thursday, we saw a prisoner release, 51 prisoners due to be released soon. And crucially, the Cuban government said that the Vatican was involved. The Vatican here is a player because 12 years ago or so under the Obama administration, it was the Vatican that was the guarantor of negotiations between the US and Cuba, because of course, these are two foes that do not trust each other. Yesterday, we got another piece of the puzzle slot in. Donald Trump had talked for weeks about how the deal would have something for Cuban Americans, for Florida. And we saw the vice prime minister yesterday in Cuba, interviewed by NBC News, announce that Cuban Americans would have from now on a mechanism to be able to invest directly in the Cuban economy. And so I think we're seeing what might prove to be the beginnings of a deal similar to the Venezuelan model, allowing the ruling government to stay in place, but instituting economic changes that the United States government has been pressing for a long time.
So just one sidebar note on this plan. Reports suggest the government was going to make this announcement last night, but the blackout may have cut off the TV transmission. So is the plan for these changes delayed or is it on?
It's always hard to tell because the devil's in the detail. Cuba has a record of making announcements and then not really implementing them with the vigor that is expected. And I think that the Trump administration is concerned that from their point of view, the Cuban government might just string them along, make an announcement, but actually stall when it comes to the implementation. I think big picture, though, the Cuban government has been in the process of tentatively reforming and privatizing parts of its economy for a number of years and opening it to private business. In 2021, for the first time, Cubans could incorporate their own companies and can employ up to 100 people. That would have been unthinkable in Cuba 10 years ago.
So before outside investors could step in, though, the U.S. would have to issue licenses to allow investments in Cuba. They'd also have to ease restrictions on travel and doing business on the island. So do Cubans expect this opening to change conditions on the ground rapidly?
I think most Cubans dare not hope anymore because they hoped 12 years ago under Obama and their dreams were crushed. And I think that what is dominant in Cuba when you speak to people is not fear, although it's there. It's despondency and hopelessness. A great many people feel crushed between two governments, the Communist Party that is increasingly unpopular, and the US government that is stopping oil getting into the country and driving down living standards. So hope is a dangerous idea these days. But certainly if the US softened or even repealed some of the sanctions legislation and allowed US companies to invest and allowed US tourists to come back, they would be very, very well received.
So regular Cubans are bearing the brunt of this crisis, clearly. Some are banging on pots in the evening in protest. Over the weekend, there were demonstrations in the city of Morón in central Cuba and vandalism at the local Communist Party headquarters. And that sort of public display of dissent is pretty unusual for Cuba. So how potent are these expressions of discontent now?
I think they're more potent because it's Cuba and it's because it's under the microscope, right? What happens in Cuba is that when there are protests, for two reasons, they're more charged. One is because it's an authoritarian state that controls public space, and there is fear of protesting against the government. Even though it's constitutionally recognized, everyone knows that actually you can't go on the street and shout down with communism, you might get thrown in jail, number one. Number two, as soon as there's protests in Cuba, because of the power of the Cuban-American lobby, it's under the microscope, unlike a few other places. And so you actually don't need much protest for it to be turned into a media event.
Ed, I have to ask you about reaction in Havana to President Trump's comments. I don't want to assume Cubans have heard him saying that he would take Cuba, free Cuba, I can do anything I want with Cuba. What have you heard from regular Cubans or the government?
A colleague that I've been working with this morning, a Cuban journalist, watched it with me, and he just said that it's so outrageously insulting, he doesn't really have words to describe. What one must remember is that the Cuban people are a nationalist people, right? And even though the government is unpopular at the moment, even though the government has lost an awful lot of legitimacy, every time there's a national power cut, they lose more popular support. They are, at the end of the day, nationalists. And the notion that a foreign president, let alone the president of the United States, this is a country that effectively colonized the island in the early part of the 20th century, says that he's going to take Cuba and do whatever he wants with it, that is a gift to the ruling Communist Party, because it allows them to say, look, this is not about democracy. It's certainly about not about human rights, because they're blockading oil and decreasing your access to food. It's about neocolonialism. It's about the colossus to the north that wants to come here and get its grubby little hands on our lithium, our coltan, our beaches, and our hotels. So I think that sort of provocative talk might well fly well with Miami, but I suspect it actually helps the Cuban government at a time when it's really looking for talking points to bolster the little legitimacy it has on the island.
Yeah, so to those words, though, take Cuba. What are the risks Washington would run if it tried to force Cuba's communist government to surrender? What might a forced transition unleash?
Well, we have the one example from Bay of Pigs in 1961. The CIA trained and financed and organized a paramilitary intervention with Cuban-American exiles at the time, and they were militarily defeated. The first and only time in Latin American history that a Latin American army and militia has beaten back a U.S.-backed invasion. We live in different times now. The government was very popular back then, the Cuban government. It's not now. And I think it's pretty clear amongst analysts that, unlike Iran, if the U.S. was to militarily intervene in Cuba, it would be a doddle. You know, they have some equipment that they can barely train with and they don't have petrol. But I don't think there's appetite for military intervention in Washington. And certainly a kind of pulling a Maduro.
Delcy Rodriguez.
Just kidnapping one of the leaders isn't really viable here because they don't have the intelligence, I think, from what my sources tell me to be able to pull it off. And so that means if you don't have the military option on the table and you're just going to economically strangle the economy until the government comes to the table, well, if they don't want to come to the negotiating table or if they don't want to agree to your demands, then there's not really that much you can do. And that's one of the amazing things about Cuba for the last two-thirds of the century, that this is the government that the U.S. has tried to overthrow for longer than any other government in the world. And amazingly, they haven't been able to do it because they're not willing to commit to the military option, at least directly. And their pressure cooker strategy of driving down living standards to get the wretched people that live here to rise up and overthrow a government they don't like doesn't work, because also there's hardly any organized opposition in the country. In other words, the regime changes in Miami that have long controlled U.S. policy towards Cuba, that have long captured it, have never been able to articulate the mechanism by which regime change would take place. If there's no opposition, how are you going to get a government in waiting to take control? That's the question they've never been able to answer. And at this point, there's no sign that mechanism exists, which is why perhaps they're talking and trying to come to a different modus vivendi.
Well, the electric in Cuba is unreliable, but evidently the birds carry on. Journalist Ed Augustin, based in Havana, thank you very much.
Cheers, Marco. Bye-bye.
This week on the program, we're looking at the housing affordability crisis and what it looks like in different cities across the globe. Today, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa, to check out efforts to make good on a promise. When South Africa became a democracy and made a lot of commitments to address the inequalities that apartheid had created, one was adequate housing for everyone. A nice idea, but no small task. Elna Schutz in Johannesburg has this report.
We call it mukuku, a small shack made of corrugated iron walls and whatever materials you can scrounge together. It's usually in an informal settlement packed tightly with others or in the backyard of a brick house.
It's a one-room shack. We bath, we cook, we sleep. Dining room is it's everything. We in a bucket. It's difficult. It is so difficult.
Tobeka Mabel Kappa laughs easily, but her housing situation in Diepsloot, Johannesburg, is not entirely funny. She lives with her daughter and three grandchildren. They all survive on her pensioner's grant, which comes to around $135 US a month. Over a quarter of that goes to rent.
And it's too expensive. You got to pay rent. If the electricity is gone, you got to buy paraffin.
Paraffin, that's oil for lighting the stove.
It's too much. I couldn't afford it.
But just recently, she got life-changing news.
They called me last week. Are you Tobeka? And I said yes.
It was the local housing department telling her she could come get the keys to her brand new apartment. She was so excited that she came 2 hours early to the Riverside development. It's a massive complex of identical grey and white apartment blocks next to a shopping mall.
I was so happy, super happy. Not even for me, for my grandchildren, you know, to have a house. And I saw the flat. It was so nice. They're going to have their own toilet, bath, because we used to go outside and it was filthy.
Once they're able to move into their new home, she says she will be able to live safely and with more dignity. But after paying utilities and other expenses, she hopes she'll also have more money to spend than before. This is the hope of most of the lucky people here, as well as many others who are waiting. It would take around 2.7 times the average income to afford the average house in the city.
1, 2, 3.
There's happy tears as a local politician snips a gold ribbon and hands over the keys. The apartment is small, two modest bedrooms, and one living and dining space. But it has a bathroom and running water.
Oh, it's the big present ever I've seen in my life. Oh, I'm glad. I'm so glad. It's been such a long time.
Felicia Lungiswa-Yoyo beams with joy. This is the new home for her and her 27-year-old daughter, who requires significant care for disability. She's especially happy about moving into a place that doesn't easily flood.
And the rain is falling. Ooh, it's wet even now. But it's not good. Don't have money to buy materials. But now I feel good when my baby gets her house. God is great, you know.
God is great, she says. The joy of the day is contagious. Everyone here is excited. Free housing is not new, though. And it hasn't been perfect. The Reconstruction and Development Program, or RDP, built millions of houses for free for South Africans below a certain income threshold. But this development today is different to the rows of identical houses traditionally built under RDP. Even though the flats are all the same, the people inside and their needs are different. The head of the Provincial Department of Housing, Tasneem Motarad, explained it to me during the handover ceremony.
I think the state of affordability depends really on your earning. We do have a large amount of people that earn less than 3,500.
The ladies you heard before have a household income of less than $200 US a month. So do around 40% of people in Joburg. They are receiving the units completely free under RDP, but their neighbours may be renting or even buying them, depending on their income.
In developments such as these, we build both subsidised and non-subsidised. Non-subsidised would be rental stock, or even bonded houses that people above the threshold can apply for bonds to be able to buy outright.
This is called integrated housing, and it was a significant change in strategy for the city of Johannesburg.
I think it was a decision that was based on kind of understanding the limitations of what had been put before, that you just couldn't create these kind of areas that were without any diversity of income. You had to create a little bit more of the neighborhood.
Independent consultant Leila McKenna has been working in the affordable housing sector for many years. She explains that the shift wasn't just to mix people, but to expand housing in the city in a more usable way.
Part of the pressure was also coming from planning. You're creating these very peripheralized and stark dormitory areas, and we need more than that.
While that ongoing effort is nudging things in the right direction, it hasn't fixed the big problem, which is how to make safe housing available to a large number of people. McKenna says that the delivery has been slow and costly.
It's very time consuming, it's very difficult, it's very complex, and then the result is pretty small. You know, it's very few units.
She says it's a problem with the model, in part because the city is growing and the program can't keep up. The upshot is many city residents are getting creative to get by. They might build a small shack in their backyard to rent out or live in bad buildings with illegal water and electricity connections. I keep thinking of something Tobeka Kappa said to me. She was one of the women receiving a new apartment. As happy as she was, it was bittersweet because leaving her shack meant leaving her landlord without a monthly check.
She's got a little boy. She's not working. And she's a very young. I'm very sad that I'm leaving her.
So now one person's good fortune becomes another person's problem. The city is trying to provide free housing, but it seems to never be enough. For The World, I'm Elna Schütz, Johannesburg.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. For many people, death is a topic to avoid thinking about, but not for the Swedish artist Margareta Magnusson. In her 80s, she wrote her first book, The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning. The book brought the concept of death cleaning to the world, providing inspiration on how to declutter as we age. Magnusson passed away last week at the age of 91. Earlier today, I spoke with her daughter, Jane Magnusson, from Stockholm. She started by explaining just what death cleaning is.
Death cleaning is getting rid of your stuff before you die so that other people don't have to take care of all your crap.
It's a thing in Sweden, right? It's not just your mom.
No, I mean, elderly women all over Sweden usually do this. And that it's women, it's usually the men who die before them, and they start having to clean up after them. But then nobody cares what old women do. So it didn't become really a concept in the way that it is now until my mother wrote about it.
Mm.
But she wasn't alone in doing this.
She just brought it to the rest of the world.
Yeah. And now it's in the Swedish National Dictionary, and I think even in the USDictionary.com. It took the world by storm because it's such a good idea. I mean, why keep all this stuff and make your family and friends suffer?
And it might sound depressing if we call it death cleaning, but your mother didn't want it to be. She said once it should be joyful and interesting. How did she make it joyful?
She really enjoyed reading all the letters she had collected over the years. She read them one by one and then put them in the shredder and threw them out.
Mm.
And same with photographs. She got to relive her life, and she found that very comforting. Mm. But she started with the big things, like stuff in the attic that she hadn't used for years, like a chair or a table or something like that, and then scaled down, and finally you're getting rid of photographs and letters.
Is there anything she did get rid of over the years that you wish you were able to inherit that was still in the family?
No, most of the nice stuff, the samurai sword or the Japanese lacquerware, stayed in the family. My nephew got the samurai sword. The nice stuff stayed in the family, and God knows there's so many of us, so it was easy to get rid of.
Did she get rid of or hand off some of that stuff before she died?
Oh, yeah. Her apartment was pretty much empty when she died.
You said that people haven't been talking about death cleaning for forever because nobody cares what old women do in Sweden. But there was an appetite for this book. What prompted your mom to write it?
Well, one of my oldest friends from university in the U.S. and I were having lunch in New York, and he was moaning about how much stuff his parents had collected over the years and that he was going to have to quit work for weeks to just clear it up. And I said, well, I don't have that problem. And he said, how come? And I said, well, my mother is death cleaning. And he said, what's that? And I told him, and then he said, I think there's a book in that. Can she write? And I said, I don't know. Let's see. And I went back to Stockholm and asked her if she could write about it. And she's like, yes. And it took her 3 months.
Wow.
And she was able to sell the book in over 30 countries.
Did your mom talk about death a lot?
Yeah, she and I talked about it all the time.
Did you find that helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. And now that's why I'm able to talk about her with so many people. Because, you know, it's sad that she's gone, but it came as no surprise. And she and I had talked about it so much. And I knew I went to see her at her elderly home in Gothenburg a couple of days ago before she died. And she knew what was coming.
And it sounds like maybe you were both somewhat at peace with that.
Yeah, well, we're all going to die. Even you are. So there's no point in shutting your eyes to that fact.
So I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that she was death cleaning basically your whole life, as long as you can remember.
Yeah.
How did you see this when you were younger? Like, you know, when you were a teenager, and were you rolling your eyes? Like, why are you doing this?
No, I wasn't rolling my eyes. We had just moved to Singapore and not all my stuff showed up, but it was stuff I didn't really want.
Mm.
And so she had gotten rid of it. And when you're a teenager in Singapore, you don't really care what your parents do, as long as they don't ground you all the time. In Singapore, she drove around in a little white convertible MG and had sunglasses and a scarf around her fabulous hairdo and smoked cigars. And that was more what I thought about. Everyone, when she picked me up from school, would be like, who was that? Oh, it's my mom.
So your mother followed up her first book with her second, The Swedish Art of Aging Exuberantly.
Yes.
How would you define what that art was to her?
Well, it's very practical advice. It's like, eat lots of chocolate. That's a chapter. She loves chocolate, but she was skinny as a thread. And she's like, oh, I'm going to die soon. I'm just going to eat chocolate now. And she did. There was chocolate in every drawer of her house.
Wow.
And she also had another chapter on wearing stripes. Because when you're an elderly woman, you don't want to look like an elderly woman, but you don't want to look like a young girl either. But stripes are quite cool. They make you look active and a little bit sporty without making you look foolish. So she always wore stripes.
I have gone through the task of going through loved ones' things who have passed away. And it can be overwhelming if there's too much, but it can also reconnect you to the person that you've lost and relive earlier versions of them. Do you miss that you are not doing that right now after your mother's passing?
No, I don't. She will always be with me, but I don't. I'm quite happy that I don't have to death clean after her. And I think my siblings are as well.
Do you death clean?
I think about it every day, but, you know, I have a ton of stuff. And so does my husband. We're really untidy. So we have to get started. He's 64 and I'm 57. And you never know when you're going to kick the bucket.
Jane Magnusson joined us from Stockholm. She is the daughter of Margareta Magnusson, the author of The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning. Thank you so much for speaking with us about your mother.
Thank you for calling me. Start cleaning.
I will get right on that. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us and join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.